What does it mean to be a Western yogi? How can someone who was born and raised in the West, who comes from a Judeo-Christian background, practice yoga and meditation in an authentic and genuine way? My name is Christopher Sartain, and this is the Western Yoga Podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. It's an overcast early spring day here in the Southern Hemisphere at our small retreat center in the Southern Andes Mountains of Chile. We just wrapped up our 300-hour yoga therapy teacher training here about a week ago. And our nephew is staying with us and helping us out with some projects and improvements that we're working on. We're fixing the, we have a wood-fired hot tub that we've been working on. It had some leaks. And we're also building a small deck, wooden platform next to our creek, big enough to put a couple of yoga mats on or towels or whatever, just for folks to enjoy in the warmer summer months that are coming for retreats and all of that. So lots going on here, and we just went to northern Chile and also to the beach and a little vacation, but it was also a bit of a working vacation. I did a Kriya Yoga initiation ceremony in Santiago, Chile, had about 20 participants. That was really lovely. And I recently ordained or authorized another Kriya Yoga teacher, Maka Labori, a dear friend of ours. And so she'll, in the future, be authorized to teach Kriya Yoga and initiate seekers into the path of Kriya Yoga. In this episode, I want to talk about how to meditate effectively. There's a lot of really terrible information out there regarding meditation and how to meditate, what meditation is, a lot of confusion over what exactly meditation is, and the difference between concentration techniques, for example, and meditation, and also the differences between mindfulness, for example, and meditation. A lot of people use some of these terms interchangeably, and they shouldn't. You know, my guru told me one time that approximately 90% of people that teach meditation should not be teaching meditation, and that's certainly been my experience as well. Anyone can simply go on to Instagram or other social media platforms, and this is fairly easy to observe, that a lot of folks that are teaching meditation and meditation techniques probably shouldn't be, and of course they have no authority to do so, and they just go to a couple of workshops or read a couple of books and decide they're ready to start guiding people spiritually through the meditation process. This should be highly guarded against. Be very careful with who you choose as your spiritual guide and meditation teacher. I can't emphasize that enough. There's a lot of fairly inaccurate information that we often hear. And one thing that really irritates me is this interchangeable use of the words mindfulness and meditation. They're not synonyms. This really came about with the popularity of Vipassana meditation retreats, where they essentially teach mindfulness meditation techniques and all of that. The word mindfulness is not a very proper use of the English language. this technique of mindfulness has nothing to do with the mind. Of course, it's the observation of the mind. And so it would be more appropriately called objective observation, because essentially that's what the practice is. It's the objective observation of whatever you're observing at the time. And so it's a non-reactive observation technique, which is highly useful, of course, in our day-to-day lives. In our normal daily life, we should try and practice objective observation and dispassionate non-attachment at all times, so that we are not reactive, so that we are calm and peaceful and objective. And so this practice of mindfulness is highly valuable, of course. But when you're, you know, formally sitting to meditate, you should try and meditate. Now, some of you know I have some issues with Vipassana, with that organization and everything, for a variety of reasons. One of those reasons is that here at our retreat center, on a couple of occasions, I've offered Kriya yoga retreats, or just meditation retreats in general. And on two separate occasions, we've had folks from the Vipassana organization show up at the retreats, and they spend the entire time trying to convert the other people at the retreats and tell them that the techniques I'm teaching aren't good, Vipassana is the only way, it's what the Buddha originally practiced. Of course, there's no proof of that, by the way. And you know, if you look at the earliest Buddhist texts, there's no mention of you know, that the Buddha practiced that particular meditation technique or what have you. But at any rate, and then one time, the lady later admitted to me that she had been sent there by people within the Vipassana organization here in Chile. I don't know if to spy on me or what, but basically, with the stated purpose of trying to convert the people at my meditation retreat and to tell them that Kriya yoga was no good and that Vipassana is the only way, etc., etc. So I don't know, you know, how the Vipassana organization operates in other countries, but here in Chile, it's a bit culty, you know. And I don't agree with their method or philosophy either. To take someone who has never meditated in their lives and allow them to attend a silent 10-day meditation retreat designed for monastic Buddhists is, in my opinion, kind of psychologically deranged. You know, I have a friend who is now schizophrenic as a result of attending a 10-day silent Vipassana retreat. And he says his schizophrenia was triggered at that retreat. And so it's a monastic practice designed for monks, for celibate monks. But, you know, any old householder, normal person can attend these retreats, and it causes a lot of confusion for people that think that peace is only possible when you're in silence at, you know, a 10-day Vipassana retreat. I talked to someone recently who told me that he had attended a Vipassana retreat, and he was so proud of himself because he was having a lot of shoulder pain during the retreat. But, and you know, in the Vipassana method, you're not allowed to move at all when you meditate. You have to sit perfectly still, even if you're in excruciating pain. And so, yeah, he was very proud of himself because he had learned to just sit there and observe his pain instead of, you know, just move around a little bit, adjust himself or find a more comfortable position to sit or what have you. He learned just how to observe the pain for hours on end. And he also said that during one of the meditations, his nose itched a lot, but sat there for an hour and a half and didn't scratch it, just observed it. And that he was able to learn how to just observe all of his neuroses and crazy thoughts and stuff without reacting to them. Now, of course, all of this can be very useful, as I've said already, especially in your day-to-day life, you know, in your normal daily activities. We should be dispassionate. We should learn how to observe objectively all changing phenomenon. Of course, you know, it's a huge part of the spiritual path, the spiritual awakening path. But when you're formally sitting to meditate, you ought to try and meditate. It'd be a far better use of your valuable, precious time than just sitting around observing your insanity or your debilitating pain. So, yes, I have some issues now. Please, if you've assisted Vipassana retreats, you find them very beneficial, you really enjoy them, take everything I say with a grain of salt. I mean, what the hell do I know? You know, keep going, go to your Vipassana retreats, and enjoy. You know, please don't, I certainly don't want to dissuade anyone from attending a Vipassana retreat who might benefit from going. But it's just, it's not what I teach, and it's not really what this Kriya Yoga path teaches that I'm a part of. My lineage was really primarily a lineage of householders. Of course, the founding, the first guru in the lineage, well, the first guru in the lineage was an avatar, Mahavatar Babaji, but the second guru in the lineage is Lahiri Mahashai, who was a householder. He was married with children, and he taught primarily householders. And he designed the practice for householders and all that, for, you know, people that have normal lives, normal duties, responsibilities out there in the world. And so I come from that tradition. And I don't come from a monastic celibate tradition where people live in cloistered environments like monasteries and ashrams and that sort of thing. Now, here, we, you know, my wife and I run a sort of quasi ashram, but it's more of a modern ashram. Of course, she and I are married and we are householders and we don't have any monastics living here. I totally respect monastics, like if that's your heart's calling and you feel like that's your dharma in this life, that's the role that you are to play in this life, and you feel more comfortable living in a cloistered environment and becoming a monk, more power to you. You know, I consider myself to have sort of a semi-monastic lifestyle. My guru also told me that he had a semi-monastic lifestyle, even though he was married and all that, and was basically a householder, but he practiced what he called a semi-monastic lifestyle, and he explained to me what that meant, and his routines and everything, and that's basically what I've adopted. And so please don't think that, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for people that choose that sort of celibate monastic lifestyle. However, that's not my emphasis, and I certainly don't think it's a good idea for people who are householders to attend retreats that are designed for monastics. But again, that's, you know, everybody has their opinions and views on these things, and so for whatever it's worth, take whatever I say with a grain of salt. You know, who the hell am I? So if you benefit from these more monastic celibate types of practices, then more power to you. So to distinguish, again, between mindfulness and meditation, mindfulness is the practice of objective observation, where we objectively observe without reaction, without participation, without identification, yeah, without judging, without analyzing, calmly, peacefully observe. And again, this should be practiced at all times, ideally, in our normal day-to-day activities. However, when we sit to formally meditate, it would be a better use of that time, in my opinion, it would be a better use of that time to actually meditate. And so let's define meditation, or jhana, as it's called in Sanskrit. It's interesting, the evolution of that word in Asia. Jhana is the Sanskrit word for meditation. And later on in China, that word was translated as the word chan. And then later in Japan as zen. And so you have this interesting evolution of that word jhana in India, chan in China, and zen in Japan. All of the words mean meditation. Meditation is a state. It is not a technique. So this is another common error that folks make. Sometimes I hear people say, oh yeah, I meditate. I use guided relaxation recordings or guided visualizations. Or, you know, I meditate with a mantra. Or, you know, I have this technique or that technique. You know, that's okay. It's not very precise, you know, but it's okay. But look, meditation is not a technique. In Sanskrit, the word for a concentration technique is dharana. And so dharana means concentration, or it's typically associated with certain techniques of concentration that we use to calm the mind prior to meditative states. Okay? But dharana is not jhana. They're not synonyms. Okay? So any technique that one might use is not meditation. Jhana or meditation is a state, not a technique. And so let's further describe this state of meditation. It is a thought-free, clear, objective, peaceful, tranquil state. What in my tradition is called superconsciousness, or a superconscious state. Okay? And so I'd like to read a passage from my guru, Roy Eugene Davis, out of his book, A Master Guide to Meditation and Spiritual Growth. For meditation to be effectively experienced, it should be understood for what it is and practiced with that understanding. The procedure is easy to learn and enjoyable to practice. Easy because natural. Enjoyable because it provides the satisfaction of measureless peace, along with progressive unfoldments of innate spiritual qualities and capacities. It allows direct access to subtle and fine levels of awareness and to fields of knowledge corresponding to them. Participation in the meditation process yields beneficial results in proportion to the attention we give it. The determining factor of results is right, regular practice with alert, attentive responsiveness to unfoldments that occur. Marginal benefits will be experienced because of physical relaxation and mental quieting, so that even beginning meditators will notice general improvements in mental attitude and overall well-being. A more useful approach is that of giving full attention to spiritual growth processes so that highest benefits can be demonstrated or actualized. Extravagant claims to the contrary, meditation is not to be thought of as an instant remedy for the everyday challenges which often attend ordinary self-conscious life. Nor will a few weeks or months of practice result in fully unfolded spiritual illumination. The satisfying benefits and improved circumstances that blossom almost from the outset of establishing a daily meditation routine can be personally rewarding, as well as reassuring evidence of the usefulness of practice. Acquiring knowledge of how to live successfully with enlightened purpose, however, is usually only accomplished within the boundaries of time. Psychological transformation and coming to terms with awakened states of consciousness, which often require that we learn new ways of relating to the world, must be experienced within the field of time if authentic spiritual growth is to be demonstrated in fact. If this were not so, planet Earth would already be populated with millions of enlightened, healthy-minded, freely functional human beings. A few thousand more years of evolutionary progress are needed before a true era of enlightenment is established. Meditation, as here presented, is not to be practiced to evoke emotionally satisfying moods, escape into interludes of daydreaming, induce alternate but still illusional mental states, or to endeavor to acquire exceptional powers for self-serving or misguided purposes. When practiced correctly on a regular schedule, meditation removes awareness from limiting conditions of every kind and returns it to the innate state of pure being. I'll repeat that last line. When practiced correctly on a regular schedule, meditation removes awareness from limiting conditions of every kind and returns it to the innate state of pure being. Any life-enhancing unfoldments that result from practice are but side benefits manifested because of physical and psychological changes and the influences of awakened spiritual consciousness. I have another passage here. When sufficiently consciously internalized, the meditator experiences spontaneous unfoldments of relatively pure levels of awareness, referred to as superconsciousness. This, in contrast to the states of consciousness ordinarily experienced, unconsciousness, subconscious states, and normal waking self-consciousness. Superconscious states are degrees of soul awareness. As meditation progresses, superconscious states become refined. With physical relaxation and internalization of attention, one experiences emotional peace and mental calmness, not as a result of suppression of feelings and thoughts, but as a result of their being quieted. The meditator, while enjoying an interlude of calm, may wonder if it is a valid superconscious episode. After successive practice sessions, confidence improves, and beneficial effects of superconscious experiences are noticed and validated. With acquired proficiency, the meditator learns to abandon self-consciousness to superconsciousness without doubting its authenticity. With further internalization of attention, awareness of physical sensations and mental transformations ceases. Expanded states of superconscious awareness then naturally unfold. During this phase of meditation practice, one can continue to be surrendered to the process, letting the soul's innate intelligence direct it. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Super clear and perfect, as usual. So, again, meditation is a state. It's not any technique that we use. Okay? It's a superconscious state above or superior to our normal, ordinary states of consciousness. It's not mindfulness. It's not a mantra. It's not a relaxation technique. It's a superconscious state of clear, objective, peaceful, tranquil, serene awareness or consciousness. Okay? Now, techniques are useful and helpful to get us to that state. Typically, we need to use those techniques. I highly recommend practicing pranayama, for example, prior to meditating. This will help relax and calm the body, the energy, the emotions, the mind. And so I typically practice pranayama for about 15 minutes when I first sit. I typically do, I've kind of got an elaborate practice, but the two most important techniques I use are Nadi Shodhana, or alternate nostril breathing, and Kriya Pranayama. which is a sort of secret technique that we learn in my tradition that is taught during the time of initiation. Very, very powerful technique. Really sort of the most effective, deepest pranayama technique that one can practice. And so I practice the pranayama techniques, and then I use a particular technique of dharana called shabda or nada or laya, or in my tradition omkar kriya. And essentially in this technique, you simply listen to the internal sound of om. You listen for the om vibration, which is the most subtle primordial sound in existence in the manifest realm. And this is a rather advanced technique, so I won't go into it in detail, but that is the technique, my preferred technique. However, most folks would do well to learn how to practice a mantra technique. It is the most popular and common dharana or concentration technique. One easy mantra that anyone can use is to simply connect the mantra with the breath. You can use Sanskrit syllables, or you can even use words in your own language that you find beneficial. But for example, you could use om on the inhale and peace on the exhale. And so as you breathe in mentally, internally, chant om. And as you exhale mentally, internally, say peace and feel peace, right? It's really more important to feel or experience the mantra than it is to say it internally or especially think about it or analyze it in any way. That's why Sanskrit mantras can be beneficial, because you won't be thinking about the meaning of it. Most of them are just syllables or And so a mantra really isn't to be thought of as a word. It's a sacred vibration. In the same way that, you know, when we're listening to music, instrumental music, we're listening to a guitar, for example, we're not thinking, oh, what does that mean? What does that sound mean? Or the piano. What is the piano saying? What does that mean? The mind isn't trying to interpret the sound in any way. We should use the mantra in the same way. So the mantras are not words. They're sacred vibrations that we use to calm the mind and prepare it for superconscious states. And so typically, the way this works is that we use the mantra or whatever technique that we choose to use of dharana until the mind is calm and serene and we experience meditation or superconscious clear state of awareness. And then we try to stay in that state for as long as possible. And then typically thoughts and distractions, vrittis, so-called in Sanskrit, return. And then sometimes we have to pick the mantra or technique back up and use it for a time until the mind is calm again and we experience another superconscious state for a period. And so on and so forth. And so it's really sort of an in and out, back and forth process. Okay, now, these prolonged states of clear super consciousness are not easy, and it requires a lot of practice, usually years of practice, before one is able to experience prolonged super conscious states. You might get a glimpse of it here and there, a taste of it here and there in your first year or so of practice. But it really requires years of practice to proficiently meditate. To meditate proficiently requires years of ardent, disciplined practice. But the promise of our practice is that these peaceful, tranquil, serene states, the duration does increase and improve over time. And so with practice, you're training yourself and training the brain through the process of neuroplasticity, to experience more prolonged superconscious states. And so that eventually, with time and practice and discipline, you will be able to experience prolonged states of clear superconscious awareness. And it is the greatest gift you will be given in this current incarnation. Sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, I feel very peaceful after, you know, I smoke weed or after a couple of beers. Yeah, you know, I've had plenty of experience with all that stuff. Let me tell you, that kind of peace, quote unquote, pales in comparison to actual peace. And the peace of your true being, the peace of your true nature, the peace of the soul, pure consciousness, pure being. And so that is the aim or purpose of the meditation practice, is to experience these prolonged superconscious states. Now, after you learn how to do that, at some point you may experience samadhi. And there are two different kinds of samadhi, typically. We have Savitarka samadhi and Nirvitarka samadhi, although there are probably subtle gradations within those. There are subtle gradations of superconscious states, too. I'm not going to go into all that. Maybe in a future podcast, I will define all of these superconscious states and samadhi states according to the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But if you want to read my book, called The Yoga Path, a translation of the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, it's available on Amazon. So you can check that out. And in that book, I do define all of the various subtle states of superconsciousness and samadhi according to Patanjali. So, you know, if you want to support me and buy that book, that would be great. Again, it's called The Yoga Path, a translation and commentary of the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. It's available on Amazon. You can find a link to it on my webpage, which is koshasbook.com, koshasbook.com. So briefly, Savitarka Samadhi is essentially just samadhi with support. It's when we experience ourselves as something other than, you know, the body, mind, personality. It could be any object that we're focusing on or contemplating. A lot of times it has to do with the inner light or the inner sound or own vibration. You experience yourself as that for a time. And so that is Savitarka Samadhi, where we lose identification with the, you know, mind-body-personality composite that we're typically identified with. And we feel a sense, experience union with something. Again, oftentimes a sound, the sound or the inner light can be any number of things. I once experienced Savitarka Samadhi with someone's laughter, and I experienced myself as the laughter. That was a very interesting experience. I talk about that in my book, The Sacred Science of Yoga and the Five Koshas, which also is available on Amazon. At any rate, Nirvitarka Samadhi is the highest state of samadhi and is typically what we think of as enlightenment, where we experience pure union. And that is an ineffable experience and really difficult to describe, but in that experience there is no subject and object. There's only a oneness beyond description. And so as you experience these refined superconscious states more frequently, at some point you can experience these transcendent states of samadhi. Again, this typically takes years or decades of disciplined practice. There are no real shortcuts on the spiritual path. Okay, Kriya Pranayama helps tremendously, but even Kriya Pranayama, takes years or decades to truly master. Okay? So we can learn how to meditate proficiently. I heard a fairly popular guru, female guru from India. Oh, a few years ago, I was watching an interview with her, and she said, "You know, if you're sitting down to meditate at all, you're doing it the right way." Huh. Sort of blew my mind that someone that, you know, millions of people consider to be so enlightened would say something so foolish. But, you know, as I often talk about, we're just coming out of Kali Yuga, which is a dark age. According to Sri Yukteswar's cosmology and his interpretation of the yugas, these time cycles or eras, and we're just entering Dwapara Yuga. At any rate, so we're just coming out of a dark age. So you have to understand that a lot of teachers are teaching things that are anything but enlightened in this, you know, semi-dark age that we find ourselves in. So again, meditation, just to review, it's not mindfulness, although mindfulness is very useful. It's not a concentration technique, although concentration techniques are very useful. It is a superconscious state, superior to our ordinary states of consciousness, in which we experience complete tranquility, bliss, serenity. Okay? And you can learn how to meditate proficiently with a good teacher. Yeah. So do some pranayama, whichever pranayamas you prefer. Nadi Shodhana is always excellent. Kriya pranayama is even better. If you can learn that from an authorized Kriya teacher. And then use some type of dharana technique or concentration technique until the mind is calm and you experience these superconscious states. If the vrittis or distractions or thoughts come back, then you return to your mantra or technique for a while until you experience that tranquil state again. And it's an organic process without any real effort. You don't want to use too much effort. If you're using effort, you're involving your mind, you're involving your ego, and that's counterproductive. And so every time you need to return to the mantra or technique, you do it with minimal effort in a very relaxed, calm manner. Yeah? And as you practice this organic process, in and out, dharana, jhana, over and over, over the years and decades, you will become a proficient meditator, and you will begin to experience prolonged states of superconscious awareness. And again, it's the greatest gift you will be given in this incarnation. Because you'll begin to know what you are. You'll uncover your true nature. And there really is no greater blessing in this lifetime. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. Please share it with like-minded souls. If you want to support me and support the podcast, I accept donations to my PayPal account. If you wish to donate, if you've benefited from this podcast over the years, I ask humbly that you please send me a donation if you feel so inclined in your heart. My PayPal account is my email address, chrissartain@gmail.com. chrissartain. Chris Sartain, my name, @gmail.com. I'd really appreciate it. Please share the podcast with like-minded souls. Lots of love. Namaste.